Thanks for joining us for day 6 of the Daily Buzz with the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, coming to you on KCPW Radio and online from Main Street in Park City, Utah. I'm Anderson Lay of the Hawaii International Film Festival, and today my co-host and I will be talking to the filmmakers of Results, Prophet's Prey, The Forbidden Room, and Glassland. Stay with us for the latest from Sundance and more. First, though, this news.
Assembling something like that,
or just beg
people to show up and get
very lucky
we got that crew to turn up and luckier still that they were all so good to us, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, Kevin I'd known for a while, so I figured he wouldn't give me too much trouble. But you never know, you know, if somebody's gonna show up. And for me, never having worked with those kind of folks before, I had some fear of Hollywood attitude, and there was none of it. There was at least not from those guys. I might have brought some Hollywood attitude, but yeah.
And Kevin,
you're generally regarded as one of the sort of the seminal character actors in Hollywood, certainly comedically and the like. You've appeared in everything from Goodfellas to Community, and this is. How does it feel to sort of be stepping into the limelight? I'd probably call you, you're the lead antagonist in this one. How does it feel to be the big man?
It doesn't really feel like anything. It doesn't feel any different from anything else I've done. It's, you know, we just did the work. Just tried to, you know, I put a lot of value in scripts and projects that try to capture people the way they really are, and this is probably the height of that endeavor. Like this is the most fun I've ever had trying to capture people the way they really are, and you know I thought that Andrew was onto it. You know, he was on a similar journey with his other films. I was already a fan of his before I met him. Mutual appreciation, and then a mutual friend introduced us, and then, you know, he went on to make a few more films, and I loved one more than, than the previous one. I loved Beeswax in particular, as you know. Yeah. And I gotta be in a movie like that. I gotta work with that guy. I gotta see how he does it, and see if I can, you know, he'll help me get closer to my goal of, you know, it's so weird because it's like, why be real anyway? Show business, you know, you're just supposed to make a show, you know. But there's this kind of a, you know, I'm curious about people and their motivations and. And we had a great time, like, exploring all that, and I loved how it came out. I think it's I spent my whole life trying to calm myself down, to curb my, I think my acting in this movie is probably the least pretentious acting I've ever done. Well, thanks, yeah, we kind of got somewhere. I don't know. There's an honesty to it.
Kevin mentioned, sorry to cut you off there, man, but Kevin mentioned sort of exploring people and characters. I was just really curious if you could give me a quick insight to how you go about writing your screenplays. Do you start with the characters and build up from there, or do you have, like, I remember sort of looking at this in the context of your last film, Computer Chest, where it was like, it was just this sort of, just like Computer Chest, it's this sort of, this original idea that no one's really addressed before, like this idea of personal health gurus being centric to the plot, and personal health being central to the plot. Like, you take these characters and you sort of apply this strange, common, but yet not regularly addressed situation. I was just wondering, how do you build that script from the ground up?
Well, yeah, in this case, I certainly did start with the characters. I mean, it actually started a little over 2 years ago when I was coming here with Computer Chest. Everybody scared me. Everybody said, when you're going to Sundance, you gotta be ready to pitch something. You're going to have to pitch. And which didn't end up happening. I didn't pitch anybody anything when I was here. But I got nervous. I had to pitch something. So I started thinking about actors. You know, I just started trying to wrap my head around the idea of, well, I got to, because I made four movies with non-professional actors, which I love, and which is in many ways still kind of my comfort zone. But I thought, all right, I got to, how can I crack this thing? What do I do with actors? And I started to think about Kevin, who I've been a fan of for 20 years. And I started to think specifically also about Guy Pearce, who I'd had breakfast with a couple years before, and just found him fascinating. Yeah. So this really did actually start with thinking about these two particular guys, and that just made me laugh already. I was like, Guy Pearce and Kevin Corrigan. What movie can contain these two dudes? And kind of built from there, and then you know, the characters started to come to me, and then the world and the situation, and so it was this, you know, kind of peculiar organic process where I didn't really know where I was going, but I had certain, which is always for me, that's how writing always is you just start with a lot of elements that you're compelled by for one reason or another, and throw them all at the wall, and then just try to figure out, what are these things doing together, what does it mean?
Was there an element of improvisation to the dialogue? Because it felt so loose and flighty. I loved it, but like it almost felt like a lot of the characters, you know, it was just coming to them naturally. Or was that completely on script?
Well, I mean, Kevin can speak to this better than I could. It's both.
I think we were pretty faithful to the script. There wasn't a whole lot of, I don't remember improvising.
One of my very favorite moments in the movie is a Kevin Corrigan improvisation all the way, which is when you close the door on a guy and then you inside and you start laughing about it. It's not about the money, brother.
Yeah,
to me, that's my favorite part of the movie, and that's all you.
That was spontaneous. Yeah, when he says, it's not about the money, brother. I thought it was funny then. It's funny now. So I was laughing, and we kept it in. That was cool.
Now, Kevin, looking at your approach, I've always, everything I see you in, you have this really unique way of delivering dialogue. It's almost like the way, when you see Alan Rickman or even Christopher Walken, the way that they say lines like no one else would say, almost like they're working on jazz rhythms. Like, how do you approach line delivery?
You know, sometimes when I can't figure out how to say a line, or even if I can't understand a line of dialogue, I'll think of some of my friends who are, I have some real characters in my life, you know. Some are dead and some are living. And it's actually two of the dead ones who I think about the most when I'm stuck. I think about how they would say the line, and then suddenly I understand the line. But also I like I'm a big music fan, and I like, you know, I have guitar players that I like who.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, who don't approach like a guitar solo in a conventional way, you know. So there's a, you know, in real life, you know, people are, you know, kind of different, you know. They sort of, everybody's kind of, you know, sort of weird, you know, have a peculiar way of talking, and you know, where are you from? You know, that kind of makes you want to know, like. Way of talking, but I, yeah, you know, there's something about also you know, I'm sort of aloof and a little guarded and a little introverted. So things come out in sputters, you know. And that's part of it too, you know. It's sort of you know, things come out a little backwards because I'm reluctant to communicate.
Well, I love the way that you deliver it, so I guess your reluctancy to communicate communicates brilliantly, unfortunately. Just kind of a wrap-up question. Andrew, like, I mean, this film says a lot of things about the state of Western society, you know, that idea that reinvention comes through physical changes rather than changes in personality. But the way that I saw it was almost an exploration of modern-day loneliness. Like, I mean, is there, like, defining idea you were shooting for with the film, or is it just a big old smorgasbord?
A big old smorgasbord, yeah.
I mean, you know, there's
everything you just mentioned sounds right to me, but I'll let you guys pick apart the themes, and yeah, I just tossed everything in there that I was thinking about.
Andrew, Kevin, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Listening to the Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and online. We're joined now by Amy Berg, John Krakauer, and Sam Brower from the documentary Prophets Pray. And joining me is my co-host John Wildman, who's going to be speaking with you. Welcome.
Okay. I've been looking forward to talking to you guys about this subject, about this guy, and how you got into it. Warren Jeffs is an infamous person and character, I think, by this point, for a lot of people. And what I really enjoyed about the documentary is how much that you are able to drill down and present that portrait that a lot of people like myself just have received glimpses of through various news reports over time. And so you go, what actually happened? What really went down there? And this film, I think, does that very successfully. What I'd like to start off with, John and Sam, I know you, the two of you have been involved with this for quite some time. Amy, how did you get involved? How did this project come to you?
Well, John obviously wrote Under the Banner of Heaven, and they're making a fictional film at Imagine Entertainment. And when John was negotiating his deal, he made sure that a documentary was carved into the deal so that this story could get out, because this is the story behind the story that is very important. And I was approached by them and very intrigued. Right away, it was just a news story to me at the time. And then when I started hearing some of the prophecies and reading some of the kind of insane dialogue coming from that camp, I was very interested in kind of understanding how people were brainwashed by this man.
And John and Sam, if you two could talk, I mean, you've been within this world, investigating it, following it for some time. And can you talk about what that experience has been for both of you?
I should clarify a little bit. I mean, after I wrote Under the Banner and Sam and I met to try to bring Warren Jeffs to justice, I have dipped in and out of it. I mean, I've had other things going on. Sam lives in the heart of it, and he's the driving force. I mean, this film takes the title, Prophets Pray, is from his book of the same name. So, you know, Sam, no one in the world knows a fraction about Warren Jeffs and these people as much as Sam does.
Well, I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Well, yeah, you've been immersed in both the Ophelia's world and Warren Jeff's you know, path and, you know, the pursuit of him. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that?
It's started years ago, and I don't think a lot of people in Utah know the depth of the depravity. And of course, when I found out, it's you get to the point where you just can't turn your back on it. It's so horrible, you just can't just look the other way and let it go by. And hopefully this film will get the word out on a national level or international level, where more people can understand what's going on, and even people in Utah and Arizona can begin to, like you say, get a feel for what happened behind the scenes and get a feel for just how sick and demented this whole thing that's going on right here in our state, in our country, is.
And can you all speak to, Amy specifically, how you were able to get the footage, the audio, because this is, by definition, the most secretive community and the most walled off, situation, and yet you guys got some fascinating footage, and some very creepy audio of Jeff speaking. So could you talk to me that?
Well, one of the greatest coups was when we were down in Texas, El Dorado, Texas, and the sheriff had recently switched his computer system over, and he reminded me that they had put a surveillance camera in the cell where Warren was staying for all those months, and he just said, "Let me just check my computer here for a second," and it turned out there were hours and hours of Warren just doing interesting things in his cell, and that kind of opened it up for us because we were able to record a deposition that took place in February based on Sam's investigation, and we also had access to all of these prophecies through Sam, and so it kind of painted the perfect picture, which was what we wanted to do in the beginning. We wanted to show the mind of Warren Jeffs and how he was able to manipulate people. So those were some great elements.
Well, it's funny, that surveillance footage, I'm glad you brought that up, because as I was watching, it had a creepiness of literally like a paranormal activity, because again, you're watching, and this is a person who, what he believes, even in himself, I mean, you go, this is it's a fascinating study. Mm-hmm. And the camera doesn't lie.
No, I mean, just watching a man stand receiving a revelation in place in his cell for hours, it's odd. Just something.
It was so bizarre and cool to see that.
Right. And the idea that he was reaching people from jail, I thought was a very important thing to show in the film, to show that there are people on the outside listening to this madman who is going insane in prison. So
that's one of the really great things about the film, too, is the fact that there is no video of Warren Jeffs anywhere. And to see that, Warren was on the run. He was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And to finally see him living, breathing in a cell and being deposed was really great.
That scene where he's on the phone to one of his followers, talking through the glass, and says, "Hold on, I'm talking to God. God's talking," and it's like, coming in, and it's like, what?
Well, E.T. phone home.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and the other, aspect of that I think the film illustrates very well is that culture of fear. And that unspoken threat, and in the interviews that you have with the various people that have escaped, so to speak, or still have one foot in, one foot out, it's one. I'd love to hear how how difficult it was to get those people to speak on camera, and what that process was like.
Well, Janetta Jessup, who was wife number 63, had never spoken to anyone before, and she did not trust many people because she had been she's been out for a bit and tried to reach out to her mother, who wouldn't talk to her, and she just felt like she was stuck between two worlds. So I thought that her interview was really emotional, and it shared a lot for me as a woman of what it was like to be brainwashed in the church. But Sam's relationships with many people who are actively fighting today against Warren and Lyle and the church and the trust. I mean, these are people who have never spoken publicly before. His former head of security, the current leader's son. I mean, these were really interesting people that had a lot to say.
Well, there are more than a few films in the fest that take its personality from audio of people speaking through this, and this one certainly does. Mm-hmm. I do have to say that I was entertaining my housemates by doing my Warren Jeffs impersonation from his God voice. But it lends a very active literally a voice to what those people that you're interviewing, what's obviously, you know, still speaking at, what they still fear and what's in their head, that threat. And what I'm curious also is, this seems a subject that could bear further investigation, even with him in jail. And I wonder if there's any ambition to do that. I know there's a you know, a narrative film that, you know, that's in process. But do you see like a possible continuation of that community?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why this is the greatest festival for this film to play at, is because there are so many people in this community here who have already reached out to us last night and today saying, how can we help? We want to put money into a further investigation. We want to help the children. We want to help the women. So Sundance is, there is no other place that we could bring this film and have this kind of immediate reaction, I think.
Well, I think the film is by its very definition a primer on Warren Jeffs, that personality and the situation with this. And congratulations, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Again, we've been speaking with the filmmakers behind the film Prophet's Prey, which is playing here at Sundance. We've had Amy Berg, the director, John Krakauer, executive producer, and Sam Brower, producer. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and online. And we're joined now by director Guy Madden and co-director Evan Johnson from the wonderful film The Forbidden Room, which I just called out yesterday as my favorite film of the festival at the end of yesterday's Daily Buzz. Guy, welcome. Evan, welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined by my co-host Dominic Mills.
I'm back for more.
And thank you, by the way, for your kind words.
Oh, you're very welcome. So I was reading through the press notes, and I know this film had kind of an unusual creative process, and I wonder if you could speak to, I know there was a master poet involved, and it was shot in art installations. Can you talk a little bit about just how this all came together?
Yeah, maybe there might be at least three things that are kind of, unconventional about the genesis of this project.
Right.
It was shot entirely in public spaces. We shot for 3 weeks, 18 days, right in a public space in the Centre Pompidou, the Modern Art Gallery in Paris, and then another 2.5 weeks in the Phi Center in Montreal, and just anyone who happened to be strolling into the building was free to watch. So we had anywhere between 1 and 200 people watching at any given time.
It must have been fun for your first AD every time they had to call quiet on the set.
We didn't bother calling quiet on the set.
I was the first AD, and it wasn't fun. I also didn't know what a first AD was supposed to do, because Guy hadn't told me, but made me do the job.
What is a first AD supposed to do?
First AD is supposed to organize the shoot, basically. All the,
schedules
all the, like, the
they
shots
do the shoot
during
schedule,
the day.
They run the set.
Yeah, and I looked up first AD on Wikipedia the night before the shoot and thought it didn't sound that hard, but it was.
Every first AD in Hollywood is cringing at that.
Absolutely, as they should.
And what about the master poet who was involved? How did that come about?
John Ashbery.
Yeah.
If you look up his Wikipedia entry, he's...
That's our primary source of research here at the Daily Buzz is Wikipedia.
That's how we make movies over here. But he's described as the most influential poet writing in English in the last half century. Anyway, he's great, and he happens to be a friend of mine. He's become a friend of mine in the last 10 years. And I asked him if he'd like to contribute, and he did add... something he wrote, the movie's framing device, the how to take a bath instructional portion of the film.
Which was delightful and had the audience tittering every time that part was on.
Yeah, his jokes come from a weird, like if he was a pitcher in baseball, there'd be a lot of Ephus pitches and, submariner deliveries and things. I don't know, it's very, very odd and it's hard to tell what he's
up to. And what was the third unusual thing?
What was it? Well, perhaps the provenance of the script itself came from a mania I had for the fact that 80% of all films from the first few decades of the art form are lost. And I started to research with Evan a bunch of lost film narratives. And at first I was heartbroken that these films were lost and unwatchable. And I figured maybe if we made a few ourselves, we could at least see them. But then I began to ghoulishly guard their lostness, and I didn't want them to be discovered because so many of the little plot ideas in there were really just eminently stealable. And by the time we finished rewriting them, they became original stories, but the origin of these things is lost films.
You've got some pretty impressive, I guess you'd call them walk-on appearances. I saw Udo Kier in there, I believe. Did I see Udo Kier in there?
Oh, you did, but actually you probably saw him more often than you realize. He travels with his own mustache collection, and he can alter his appearance radically. And so even big Udo Kier fans were not recognizing him frequently in the movie. I think he's in six different characters.
Cast overall, you had an amazing cast for this film overall also.
Yeah, it was great fun in Paris working with Mathieu Amalric.
He was freaking fantastic.
Yeah, Geraldine Chaplin and Charlotte Rampling put in a few days, four days worth of work with us. And I don't know, and then people like Jacques Nolot and people are very, just famous for great work from various depths of the underground world and to the shimmering surface of, celebrity. So,
was it the ambition of the project that attracted you that attracted all these sort of these big names to that then?
Yeah, we were they're adventurous performers. We were lucky to meet up with a really cool and hooked up casting director in Paris who just knew the kind of French actors, and that's a smaller community there than in America. He knew the kind that would dive into something adventurous, and the idea of acting in public appealed to some, and our casting director didn't bother contacting the ones that he felt would not be excited by that.
Evan, let's jump over to you. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in this project and what it was like co-directing with Mr. Madden?
Well, I got involved as his research assistant at first, researching lost films, because there are thousands of them, and it's sometimes hard to find the information.
But research assistant to co-director is a pretty big leap.
Yeah, it's a big jump.
I assume you didn't kill anybody on the way there, so...
I can't talk about that here, but I don't know how I managed that, but...
Well, maybe that forces you to be too modest. You were just, your contributions were far greater than mine. You had tons of great ideas, and
I didn't have a job I liked, and so I just threw myself into this project. And eventually, we were writing the script together with our fellow screenwriter Bob Kotick, and then we were just finding images. We just started to plan the shoot of the movie all together. So.
I want to sneak in a question about the visual style of the film, which is just beautiful and striking, and like scene after scene, you're just washed over by different color palettes. And you also work with Ben Kosolke a lot. He was one of your DPs on this, I think, in the Paris side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've collaborated with Ben quite a bit. I just wanted you to talk more about your visual style and how you and Ben work together, and how you and Ben and Evan all work together to get that.
Going back 10 years, I just met Ben in a kind of a forced marriage on a project in Seattle called Brand Upon the Brain, which was one of my movies.
One of my favorite films also.
He was assigned to me, and he's just got an amazing temperament, and he knows how to get into the spirit of the shoot. And I like to shoot too, and so Ben and I just grabbed Super 8 cameras, and we would, I don't know, he picked up the style I wanted, and after a while, we couldn't tell each other's footage apart. And I remember thinking, man, that's got to be my shot. But then seeing myself in it, which meant Ben had accidentally shot me and things like that. And he's really wonderful. But then he'll go over to another director and sync up with that ethos. He's just a wonderful spirit on set as well. And so I just wanted to marry him as my DOP for life. It wasn't always possible.
And in this film, though, the visual style is so poetic and lovely. Yeah.
Well, thanks. We switched raw digital there, which I felt really denuded of my mojo there, because I was used to having film what you see with the naked eye transformed by emulsions into something you can't see with the naked eye. Right. But raw digital footage just looks too close for my liking to what you can just see before you. And so I was really having trouble building up a kind of hubris, a gracious hubris that you need to strut around set and get shots and suck up images with your little camera.
Right.
But that's where Evan came in. But Ben was as confident as he should have been, because he knew what could be done with color timing afterwards. And Evan isn't just my co-director, but he's my color timer. And so there was a lot of palette manipulation done after the fact. A lot of it done by the production designer beforehand, Galen Johnson. But then... because you got to at least give the color timer a chance. But then we just tried to come up with palettes. Well, Evan can talk about it, but it seemed like at one point we had picked our favorite palette was a kind of violets and browns, which just really kind of seemed like kind of enteric palettes, you know, like something like an ill-digested.
This is not really the effect you want.
Something you would feel better if you just voided yourself of those palettes, you know. But Evan kept working on them and finding new palettes that were even deeper boweled.
I would love to sit here and talk about your visual style for hours and hours, but we are unfortunately getting our wrap-up signal, so we're going to have to wrap this up.
Okay.
Again, we've been speaking with director Guy Madden and his co-director Evan Johnson from the film The Forbidden Room. Wonderful film. You have some more screenings coming up here at Sundance?
We have something in Salt Lake City on Wednesday night, and then I think there's one more.
Check your Sundance schedule, and I highly recommend you see The Forbidden Room. If you've never seen Guy Madden's films, it's a great introduction.
Zillion thanks.
Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thus far. Actually fantastic. It's my first time here, so it's pretty special. I think it's on the filmmaker's bucket list. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Come to Sundance once and hopefully twice.
You know what else is really special? Your film. Yes. Now, I want to start off by asking you about the way that you approach dialogue. Yeah. You have a real, a really almost theatrical sensibility. I've got a lot of Jez Butterworth in there. How do you approach writing a screenplay?
Less is more for me, anyway. It's kind of like I like to give my audience credit that they're much smarter than I am. So I like to give them less is more for them to put the piece of the jigsaw together themselves, and just try to be real and honest. I think it all depends on the project, you know. I think it depends on specifically, you know. This is a tough piece. I'm not going to lie to you. It's very kind of brutal and full on. And I think more than anything, what I want to do with it is I want it to be real. And for that, I just wanted the dialogue to be real and honest. You know, I'm doing a movie in the summer, and you know, that's a different kettle of fish again. And I need to adapt differently to that. But for this, I wanted to keep it real, raw, and honest, and just kind of to the point. You know.
It is quite a brutal film, but at the same time, there's a poetic realism to some of your lines. Like, there are moments where your characters will almost lapse into this kind of lyrical way of speaking, hypnotic. They'll semi-repeat the same lines over and over again. Like, how do you go about sort of fitting that? I mean, it works perfectly. How do you go about sort of fitting those slightly more lyrical moments into what is otherwise sort of a very sort of socially realist kind of script and setup?
Yeah, I think hopefully it works. I think, like, for me, more than anything, it's just about keeping it real for the characters. I mean, you know, you can't have people. For me, I try my best for people to speak like they speak in normal life, but you can't really do that in movies. You gotta build it up a little bit more. But for me, it's just like finding the voice of that character, putting the time and work into that, and just trying to make it something unique. And I think that, you know. Like, you know, my first film was about a farmer living alone in rural Ireland, and the one thing I wanted to do with that more than anything was, men don't usually speak about their feelings, and a 50-year-old man in rural Ireland living alone does not speak about about his feelings. So what I did with that was, this guy talks all the time about his feelings, he's constantly talking, and it's kind of a revelation for the audience, because you can suck them in that way. You can deliver loads of information. And then I think with the right lines, you can really hit their hearts, you know?
Okay, I just very quickly want to talk about the cast.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've got some big names in there. You've got Michael Smiley playing a guy who is an absolutely terrifying force, which is, I didn't see coming. I see Jet Reno as, like, one of the most important Irish and British actors of his generation. Like, what was it like working with him?
Well, he was actually born in Colorado, so he's Irish-American, actually, and he's he's very kind of, Jack is incredible. I think Jack is one of these actors. He reminds me a lot like Tom Hardy, a young Tom Hardy. It's kind of like, you know, he's not worried about how he looks. He's not, and he doesn't come across self-conscious on the screen. He's just real. And when he's sitting in the car, you believe it's his car. When he's sitting in the house, you believe it's his house. And he's just, he's a very special actor. And he's, it's all about the work with him. He's incredible. Tony Dean is just an incredible, I've always admired Tony. And to get the chance to work with her. Yeah, Toni Collette is incredible. And she's somebody that came on this and took a chance to receive in Ireland. And she came and she did it for 4 days. I only had it for 4.5 days.
Really?
Yeah, and she was incredible. And then Will Poulter, who I think is a phenomenal, phenomenal. I think Will and Jack, the both of them, are probably, I would say, two of their age group.
Absolutely.
Two of the best in the world.
Yeah, Will Poulter, like, he sort of, he came, not quite out of nowhere, but sort of he came through British television. And, like, you wouldn't really see it coming that he's like this, because there's a couple of really powerful scenes in this film featuring him. But at the same time, he provides this kind of, this almost much-needed touch of humor to things. And, like, how important was it to instill, like, this element of humor to the in the film?
I mean, have you seen Son of Rambo?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, that was here when he was 8.
I'm all right.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And he could never come here. So for him to come for this was incredible. And, Will is just special. I mean, he's doing The Revenant now with Tom Hardy and Leonardo DiCaprio and the guy that directed Birdman. I mean, he's just moving from strength to strength to strength. And he's a special human, right? He's a special human. And it's Smiley, who I just adore. An Irish man that has never been in an Irish film. And I wanted to, you know... No, never been in an Irish film, and he's an Irishman. And I wanted to... There's so much depth to Smiley that... You know, it's easy to pass him off as a villain character or a nasty character, but I think he's beautiful in this.
Absolutely.
The way he takes Jack under his wing, he kind of becomes his father in a weird way, you know?
I wanted to also talk about the visual aesthetic of the film. Obviously, it's a pretty gritty-looking film, as it should be with this kind of subject matter, but at the same time, you sort of... One thing that I realized when I sat back and I thought, I can tell this is a great film because... Within the first 20 minutes, I knew the layout of the house. Like, I could have drawn you the floor plan of the house that Jack Rayner and Toni Collette's characters live in. Like, how did you go out shooting all those interiors? Because it feels really claustrophobic.
Yeah, it's important. I think, like, the house is probably one of the main physical characters in the film. It's a frightening house, like.
It is.
I mean, and that's real, to be honest with you. I didn't touch that house much. I mean, the floorboards creak, really. There's hammer marks on the door, really. The walls are that damaged, really. It's important for me to give the audience that they know their way around the house. Because Jack's character, like, when he walks into the house, he's actually more nervous than he is inside and he is outside.
Yeah.
So you know exactly where he's going and what's he doing in the room of the house. And yeah, it was just kind of like, you know yourself watching movies sometimes from the filming studios, you know, just that room is built, that's it. You don't feel the house is real. So, no, we did it for real. It just allowed the audience to even immerse themselves more in it, geographically inside. So, but look, you hope people will pick up on this stuff. Thankfully, they have thus far. I mean, that's the trend.
Well, like something that I picked up on, I might just be imagining it, but there's an incredible emphasis placed on doorways and thresholds.
Yeah.
Characters are constantly hovering in doorways, just like metaphorically, Toni Collette's character is sort of on the threshold of like her alcoholism killing her. Jack Rayner's character is pretty much on the threshold of sanity at all times. And, like, if you could just talk to me about, like, what it represented to you.
It represents, you know, the characters trying to escape, you know? I think doorways is a really interesting way to frame a character and to enclose them and to emphasize that they want to escape. And you know, I've done that in my first film as well. I like doorways. I like doorways, yeah, I like it. I think it's a beautiful framing device. And as I said, hopefully people pick up on these things because that's why you decide to do them that way, you know?
I should hope they do. You have, like, you instill not only your characters, but just the film. Whilst it's quite a bleak film, but it has an ultimately positive message, I like to think. There is, yeah, it's a redemptive tale, yeah. Like, you instill, in spite of these, like, Toni Collette's character could be completely unlikable in the wrong hands. Like, she's, she's done a lot wrong in her life. Like, how do you go about instilling your characters with, like, this, there's this base sense of humanity and, like, belief that there's some goodness in everyone? Like, how do you go about that?
I think the gift that Toni gives you is never really played a Caribbean character before, a really nasty person, but I think what I knew she could do, and in fact she did, was, yeah, she can play nasty, but there's still beauty underneath there. You know, it's like when she freaks out in the kitchen and she's on the floor crying. You know that there's just someone crying in there to get out. And she can do that. She can bring various facets to that whole thing. I think that's what intrigued her about doing this, is that she could show that she could do that thing. She's amazing.
Yeah. But, like, just even going further into it, just, like, do you believe in people? Do you believe in, like, this, like, there's goodness in everyone? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think that it's all our responsibility to be good, you know? I mean, if you're walking down the street and there's someone lying down, or somebody has fallen down, I mean, you should pick them up, like, but not everyone does. And I think that Jack Renner's character is just, he's a good man. He's a really good person that just gets pulled into something that he doesn't even realize he's getting pulled into. And then he just realizes it at the end. And I think, you know, that scene at the end where he's standing in the middle of the road looking up and down, and we move back and see Tony in the room with the other guy, you know, is that a dream or did it really happen? And that's kind of like, you know, I wanted to leave the audience in a way where, kind of, you know, more than anything, what I wanted people to leave the film was wondering, like, where is that guy now?
Well, I've got to wrap up now, but just very quickly before we go, what is it like? First of all, this is your first Sundance experience, and also yours is one of the first, like the only proper British films on show this year. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, a film from the British Isles.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, one of the only Irish films on show. What is it like being at the forefront of that, having to bring the Irish message to the people of Utah?
There's been an Irish film here last year. They're, like, our industry is in a very healthy state at the moment in Ireland. And I think that my generation of filmmakers, we're starting to graduate and kind of, like, you know, we've done our dues in college and, you know, Jim Sheridan, Neil Jordan have paved the way for us to kind of come through. And there's some great stuff coming out of Ireland now, and I think that it will continue to do so. I think that there's been an Irish film here every year for the last 5 or 6 years. So, it's going really well. I think that it's all about just kind of keeping the show on the road. And there's a huge Irish contingent here in Utah. I mean, I met a good few people last night after the premiere, and so it's a very strong contingent here.
Gareth Barrett, director of Glassland. It's an amazing, amazing film. I love it very much.
Listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and online. We're being joined now by John Cooper, the director of the Sundance Film Festival. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I'm also joined by my co-host Anderson Lee and James Faust. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hey, Cooper, how's it going?
Good.
This is the midway point of the festival. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. My predictions have all come true.
We're having a great time here, and I think, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but just talking about like the industry part of the festival. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a lot of reports of big sales and stuff like that. So, it's do you think it's a return to the heyday of?
I don't. I never would predict that, mm-hmm. but. It feels good, though. You know, whenever filmmakers come out of this festival better off, sustaining careers, out of debt, I am very happy for them.
Yeah. And for my personal opinion, I think the next section is fantastic this year.
I think so, too.
Yeah. And then, for example, one of my favorites is Tangerine, James White, Bob and the Trees. I mean, when you guys came up with the idea of the next section, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah,
or?
It was my first year, so 6 years ago.
Years ago, okay. Yeah. What was your was this your intent? And I mean, 6 years ago, I think it was a different landscape, but now in a way, I think the buzz is like that the next section is really kind of capturing the spirit of Sundance.
Yeah, and that's what it was. We thought at that point that maybe we were, you know, we constantly follow the artists at this festival, so we're mm-hmm. trying to be. You know, we're responders, not so much changers and
right.
creators. So
right.
I noticed that sometimes there was a whole trend of filmmaking that was maybe getting overlooked, not just by us, but sort of everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that there was a solid place. You have to carve out a place for these films to be. So we put on a whole different hat when we look at the next section. And mm-hmm. what the next section's taught us is that it changes every year even unto itself. And mm-hmm. we had to kind of go, well, that's what it is. It is going to be the next, and it comes from the artists, and they will tell us what to do.
Well, and also another buzzword, I mean, coming to TV, television, mm-hmm. right? So, I look at, like, say, Lynn Shelton is a perfect example of, like, a kind of a Sundance darling. She's had many of her films play. I mean, almost all of her films premiered there at the festival. But she's also, you know, kind of mined a career in TV as well. I mean, where do you see TV and its placement in the festival?
I think, you know, there's places in their careers, first of all, because it's lucrative. It helps them sustain, you know, their life. I like that it helps them stay independent in the filmmaking realm because they have this other outlet. But it's all blending, you know, the freshness that we're seeing in TV, the you know, pushing buttons, pushing boundaries, breaking through. I think that's coming from a lot of it. It's not just Lynn Shelton. There's many, many. Mm-hmm. When I watch TV shows, you watch the credits. Like, oh, there's that director.
Yeah,
he had that film, that crazy little film, and now he's doing, you know. People are very clever out in that, in the industry to know that these filmmakers have something else that they're going to bring to the set that I think keeps their actors on their toes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got a couple. I was wondering, so Sundance, always, I remember I speak to some of the programmers here, and it's like the greatest place for American cinema. But in the last, I say, 10 to 15 years, it's been a great place for global cinema.
Thank you for saying that. It is so hard to get that message out.
Well, it's true. I mean, the amount of, I mean, even, am I correct? Is there Sundance, is there International Sundance Labs now? And,
right.
And I was talking with the filmmaker, Prashant Nair from Amrique.
Right.
Yeah, and he was talking about, it's a great place for filmmakers from around the world to be. So talk about the global expansion of what you guys have done.
You know, there's a global expansion of our outreach to get these films. So this is the 10th year of our world cinema competition. Mm. So that just, it's hard to cover the world. So really the people that go out there in the world are the filmmakers that we've had here. So we see, you know, we have a filmmaker here from Lithuania. You know, she'll probably go back and then we'll get more films from that country. It's hard to reach out. So I try to send them out with not just a message, but as ambassadors for us. And what we've, on the other side, we've been looking to expand, you know, outside of our borders for building appreciation for American independent film. It was fading a little bit, especially in Europe, that we used to always be a part of the dialogue there. And just little by little, it was like becoming less and less, fewer films going to, you know, London, France, Germany, the bigger hubs. And we thought, well, we just have to just, the films do the work for themselves. So if you get them there and you find a way to get them there under the Sundance brand, people will pay attention. And London's been great. Yeah. London's like, you know, great audiences. The filmmakers have an amazing time, and now we're in Hong Kong too.
Oh wow,
that's right. Yeah.
So we just started that last year.
So
hopefully,
the London portion's in the spring.
Yeah, in the late spring.
Late spring, and in the Hong Kong. Yeah, the Hong
Kong September.
Portion in September. That's fantastic.
It's like year round.
Yes, and also, I feel it. But it's good. It's all good. You know what's great too? Yeah. Traveling with these filmmakers. This is such a a condensed experience for everybody. That's kind of nice to few months. Then you travel with these filmmakers, you get to know them. I spent all this time with Craig Johnson, you know, who did Skeleton Twins.
Right.
I didn't really know him, but he's like, you know, you kind of get into their spirit. Then he was going right on to do an episode of Looking right from that.
That's right.
So. Yeah. Another thing I love, one real quick, New Frontier. My very first Sundance was 10 years ago, and I got a ticket to a New Frontier film, and my fiance at the time went into some sort of epileptic fit, and it was but ever since then, she was at the time, so she's gone. So I love that she went into an epileptic fit. But I've always loved that section.
So
and
now you take your girlfriend to New Frontier first to test out the.
Yeah, my wife would kill me. She goes, "You'll never take me to one of those shows." But I love the New Frontier. I love that support of that filmmaking. It's not Next, but it's really
that was like the original Next.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah.
It's I think of it as the film part of New Frontier is one thing. I think that really formal, experimental filmmaking, and we have to support that because there's enough community out there and there's audience for it. But then there's New Frontier, the place, which is now all the virtual reality.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Have you done any of the Oculus yet?
I love it. Oh, it's hard to explain yeah. how you do it.
Until you do it. It didn't work for radio, but it definitely.
But stepping into those images and being in the story, and now we're seeing these people connect stories that are really emotional. I did one called Ascent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I saw
about
that.
The father and that, son. Yeah. I mean, that wiped me out. Yeah. And Birdly, where you get in that contraption and you fly over San Francisco. It's amazing.
Sadly, they take photos of us looking like idiots and stuff like that.
I don't care. I can
But can we talk, just talk about also just on the local part, the expansion of your venues in Salt Lake City and Ogden and Sundance Resorts. Right. It's fantastic.
We built such a... Every filmmaker that goes down to Salt Lake says, that was my most amazing screen. Yeah. It's impossible to tell them that before they get here.
Right.
Because they're like, oh, do I have to go? Do I have to go down to Salt Lake? It's like, you want to go there. And then they always come back and go, you're right. You know, we've built such a pocket of real solid film fans. Like the film knowledge, it's like if you did infrared thing over the middle of Utah, it'd just be this glowing little thing of like film knowledge. Mm-hmm. And they recall... films from like 20 years ago and they just it's just working.
Right.
If we can get the whole world to do that, we'll be hitting our mark.
I think
I went to some of the SLC screenings, and the Grand is a new venue.
The Grand is a new venue, and it's nice and big, so it just means more tickets, more access for people. I know that's it's hard to there's a lot of hunger.
Yeah. So what's in store for the final days?
We're switching over. We added a new sort of program. It's called Art of Film. Mm-hmm. We're concentrating all the off-screen things, the panels, the talks are all based on the craft of filmmaking. We found it as the industry sort of leaves and sort of the film fan base comes in that they really love hearing about cinematography and art direction and casting. So we're putting it all for that, and we're kicking it off with a panel with Robert Redford and George Lucas with Leonard Maltin.
Wow.
So that's big.
Yeah, three
I never thought that was my dream. That's like a dream you do.
I have a ticket.
Hold on to it and try not to sell it.
Get my flight back on that flight. No. Yeah. Oh, do we still have time?
Unfortunately, we do not. We would like to continue talking with John, but we're getting our wrap-up signal from Irene Cho. So
I could talk to you all day.
We could talk to you all day. but we know you're very busy here at the Sundance Film Festival.
I do just want to say that, I just want to say that congratulations on under your regime, so to speak, under your that the Sundance brand is really stronger than ever. And the fact that you're doing all this great stuff, but also the Sundance labs that you do in the different various cities around the country, really helping with emerging filmmakers and also the global brand. It's just amazing.
It's a circle.
Yeah.
It all circles, but all comes back to here, the middle of Utah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Again, we've been speaking with John Cooper, director of the Sundance Film Festival. Thanks so much for making time from your schedule to stop by.
Wrapping up today's edition of The Daily Buzz, I'm Anderson Lay. And we want to thank KCPW, Merrill Trailscape, the Yarrow Hotel, Pop Art Snacks, Boxed Water, Cloud Electronics, Angry Porcupine, Skull Candy, Cotopaxi, Naja Fam Lockwood and David Lockwood, The Market at Park City, You Offend Me, You Offend My Family, Beyond Right and Wrong, and the show's producer is Irene Cho.